That's really good.
I'm not going to be here reading anyway.
Just to reverse the drug ban here, so.
Interrupt 2 days.
Both dumb farmers and makers and miners.
First part of the session.
Both device. Many speed felonies, not even knowing it.
Referred to myself as a half-wit in a committee yesterday.
Oh, great. Hope they got that on record.
Hey, Bill, it's like Courtney said to Larry, this is the bozo side of the committee.
Are you ready for the bomb, though?
I'm ready.
Okay.
For what?
The bomb, though.
Yeah, we may have to have a quorum here pretty quick if we're not careful.
It's this time.
What is she?
She's Courtney. They'd be happy to trade places.
Think so?
I think so.
Really?
Let's do it.
Okay, are we going to...
Damn.
Four.
Going for quality instead of quantity.
Well, the reason I'm waiting for Representative Mannix is he's kind of crucial on the first bill.
Oh.
And the Mannix.
What? You missed the last time. He's always kind of little.
Oh, is that right?
That's true, but here's your excuse.
Mr. Chairman, the Republicans are all here.
Are they all here?
Courtney is here, so why don't we... Representative Courtney. Representative Courtney, if you could sit down. The... January 25th meeting of the Criminal Crime and Corrections Subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today's agenda includes House Bill 2188, House Bill 2191, House Bill 2298, and House Bill 2263. We're kind of in a holding pattern here for a second, waiting for Representative Mannix on the bomb bill 2188 because he worked on a particular amendment. So if there are no objections, I would like to jump ahead to 2298. That's the Employment Division bill. Now, this bill, is somebody here from the Employment Division? Somebody's here from the Employment Division.
Oh, yeah.
This bill is a kind of an interesting bill in that it involves Employment Division law. Apparently there was an incident in which somebody reported a felon or something to that effect. I'm probably misstating it terribly. Somebody reported a felon in some type of interaction in the Employment Division and then suffered some type of consequence in employment. Before I turn these guys loose on us, what I would like to say is that we've had a very, very strong request from the House Labor Committee via one of our 800-pound gorillas, Representative Shiprack, and he would like to have the bill. I've looked at the bill, and it doesn't turn me on either way. I think it's a nice little idea. But unless somebody is really in love with this bill, I would suggest that we re-refer it to the Speaker and to be re-referred to the House Committee on Labor. Now, does anybody have an absolute passion for this bill?
Chairman, do you have any idea what Representative Shiprack's intentions
are? Well, is apparently there are all kinds of federal regulations involved here, and monstrous amounts of federal money, like $300 million or something, really real money. And apparently that we have to do this, we get to do it right. So at least we do it wrong and lose $300 million of the federal money, something to that effect. I would rather send this little time bomb or tar baby or something over to Representative Shiprack's committee. So discretion being the better part of valor. Any objection to that? Okay, so ordered. Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Wasn't that easy?
Great, very appreciate it.
Okay.
Over any time.
Did you want to go there?
Yes,
but you did want to go there.
Yeah, they did, yeah. That's why they're not going to say anything, you see. Okay, we're still waiting for Representative Mannix, so... Is Mr. Penn here yet? Or somebody from Mr. Penn's office?
I got something
better. Are you?
Yeah. Are we?
under rules.
Are we?
What?
What are we going to do about that? Stay here no matter what?
We're going to try to be through by four.
Okay.
Mr. Penn is not here at the moment, so why don't we, I usually like to go in order, but since we don't have our witness here, why don't we go to 2263? I don't have the witness list in front of me. I assume it's Mr. Crawford and Mr. Horton.
Let's take a look at this.
All right, Mr. Crawford. Anybody else on 2263? 2263, if I can summarize it for the committee, is a, as you know, in Oregon, we have essentially a recog system, a system that allows you to be released either on recog or with a 10% deposit. Basically, all 2263 does is allow a situation where if the judge wants to, the judge can ask for the full amount, or I assume this could be done either the full amount or 10%, either one, right? And a corporation can put that up, essentially a bail bond. So it's just a kind of adding on to the present system. And I don't think, in my judgment, it does any harm to the present system. If it did, I wouldn't like the bill. But if it doesn't, Mr. Crawford.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Hank Crawford, and I'm before you representing AmWest Insurance Company, who is an insurer doing business in the state of Oregon in the field of surety bonds. I want to give you just a very brief overview of how we got to here. Actually, this piece of legislation was introduced into the 1987 legislative session very late in the session. And as a matter of fact, the late Senator Bill Frye and I made a decision about three quarters of the way through that with all of the backlog we had, much of which was caused by tort reform debates, that both this subject matter and my client would be best served if we just didn't pursue the bill any further at that time. We did pursue it then through the process of the interim committee, and the bill was introduced through that process by our efforts and our request. I've asked Pat Horton to join me. Mr. Horton has not only had a great deal of experience in this field, but has been an author of law journal articles about the field, drafted the basic draft of the bill, and I think that your summary is a reasonable summary, Mr. Chairman, and will not try to expand that role beyond what the questions may be that you have. And with that, I'd like to introduce to you Mr. Pat Horton, who will proceed with the testimony on the bill.
Mr. Horton. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here as legal counsel for AmWest Surety Insurance, previously referenced by Mr. Crawford. In 1973, the Oregon legislature made some sweeping procedural changes in Oregon's procedural criminal law. And part of that was to abolish the bail bond system, which had been in existence in Oregon for nearly 100 years prior to 1973. They went to the 10% system. It is a government-subsidized, government-funded bail system where a defendant posts 10% of the surety, or pardon me, 10% of the security with the state government. To assure his or her appearance in court. The law in 1973 also provided for a conditional release where the court could impose certain conditions or restrictions upon a defendant to, along with a release. And third, it provided for a release on one's own recognizance. That provision pre-existed the 1973 legislation. But that was the only three forms of release which was provided for, and no longer after 1973 did we have corporate surety or corporate bail. Corporate bail or corporate surety is a situation where a licensed insurance company, writes a bond to the court or to the state, promising that the defendant, their client, will appear at all scheduled times before the court. Should that defendant fail to appear, that bond is forfeited by the court, and the face of the amount of the bond then must be paid to the state of Oregon.
When I was district attorney in Lane County for 12 years, I was constantly impressed with the failure to appear rate that occurred under the 10% security release system. The 10% system had a lot of advantages, and we are not here suggesting today that the 10% system be abolished or in any way changed. What this bill provides, 2263, provides is reintroduction of corporate surety as another alternative to the courts in determining the type of release that a criminal defendant may be eligible for. Throughout the United States, industry statistics show that the failure to appear rate on corporate surety is approximately 2 to 3%. We did a comprehensive study in Lane County a couple of years ago, and it ended up being published in the Oregon Law Review, volume 66, number 3, which was a statistical evaluation of the failure to appear rate of criminal defendants under the 10% system. The results were shocking to many people who were not intimately involved in the criminal justice system. Most police officers, judges, and prosecutors know intuitively that the failure to appear rate is anywhere between 25 and 40%, depending upon the jurisdiction and the type of offense. The failure to appear rate over the 3 to 4 year study that we did in Lane County was 22% under the 10% system. The problem with the 10% system is that it only goes halfway. You see, it replaced the bail bond system. The corporate surety system, the reason that it has a 2 to 3% failure to appear rate is because the bail bondsman ensures the appearance of the defendant at court. The alternative to that is bankruptcy for the company, financial disaster. The 10% system provides for security release officers who are employees of the court, of the judge, to screen people at the jail to get them out of custody if possible, as soon as possible. But their job ends after the release decision is made. There is no monitoring of that defendant, his whereabouts, whether or not he continues employment, or whether or not he appears in court as scheduled. That's the one failure of the 10% system, is that the security release officers do not have the ability to monitor the whereabouts of the defendant and to ensure their appearance in court. And I suggest that that is one of the main reasons of the extremely high failure to appear rates. What this bill does, it keeps intact all of the present release criteria. We're still going to have security release officers at the jails getting people released. We're still going to have a release on one's own recognizance program, a 10% program, and a conditional release program. This adds another option to the police, the prosecutors, and the courts, and that is it provides for corporate surety. It provides for a type of release that is more structured and we feel is going to ensure the appearance of more defendants at the time of trial. It's a fairly simple bill to read. It's not extremely long. It provides for that insurance companies must be licensed and regulated by the insurance commissioner's office. The alternatives that I have mentioned, and it also provides for a 180-day period of time to determine whether or not the failure to appear, if one exists, is intentional on behalf of the defendant, and to allow a corporate surety to locate the defendant and through the assistance of police officers cause him or her to be arrested, and then to apply for remission to the court of the bond. And that is discretionary with the trial judge. That's an overview of the history of this particular piece of legislation and also its major provisions. Chairman, I stand ready to answer any questions should the committee members have any.
Any questions of Mr. Horton, Mr. Crawford?
Mr. Chairman.
Lord.
Are there individual, I assume there is such a thing as a bond. Are there individual bonds for every case, or do these companies, including the one that Mr. Crawford represent, make some kind of arrangement with a court and then do a supplement for each one, or how does that work?
No, an individual bond will be written for each named defendant for each case and filed with the court.
So then each one stands on its own then?
Each one stands on its own merits and is subject to forfeiture in the full amount of the face of the bond should the defendant fail to appear.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, it may be interesting, and each of you could easily check this in your own districts, but we have found in just speaking to law enforcement people as we become interested in this that there are jurisdictions where they will run at any given time as high as a 50% and 60% no-show. That is one of the reasons that some law enforcement officials have shown a very big interest in this, because they feel it gives them an alternative for those who they have strong suspicions may not show back up.
Representative Courtney.
Just simply, please, I don't understand why if someone's going to run at 10, they won't run under this. And you understand, they're going to run?
Well, I suggest that the presence of a bondsman historically is to monitor the whereabouts and the employment, the living conditions, and they are in a position to readily determine if a defendant might flee, whereas a security release officer is not. And I think that is borne by nationwide statistics on the failure to appear rates.
So that means after the release, the monitoring system is much more intensive than under the 10%.
Yes.
What about prior to the release? What kind of system, if any, do you have for that kind of situation in analyzing whether or not this is a good candidate, or you simply don't have that ability, probably, do you?
Both the security release officer, the employee of the courts, and a bondsman go through the same criteria to determine whether or not a release might be appropriate. And that, of course, is defined by statute presently. And concentrating on various criteria, employment, how long one has been in the community, they own their own home, that sort of thing, which would create an impression that the defendant has ties to the community and is probably going to appear.
Any other questions? Representative Pillari.
From the standpoint of the accused, in addition to you monitoring more, does he have more at stake? Does it cost more if you go after him is there any of that aspect to it?
Well, under the present system, the defendant posts 10% to the court. Should he or she fail to appear, they are subject to being pursued civilly by the prosecutor. Now, that realistically never happens because they're gone. So the state is left with holding the bag. In other words, they forfeit if it's a $10,000 security, they forfeit the $1,000 that the defendant has posted with the state, and they write off $9,000. You see, in 1973, when this was touted so highly before the legislature, this was going to be a revenue-generating device for the courts, because we were going to be able to successfully go after and sue and collect the 90% of the security upon a failure to appear. Well, practically, in my knowledge, that has never happened. I know of no single case where a prosecutor has located and sued successfully a defendant. Now, with a corporate surety, there is no problem because the bond is forfeited and the company pays up. But insofar as any disability on an individual defendant, no. The defendant's either going to pay 10% to the state, or they're going to pay 10% to an insurance company. Or they're going to be released on their own recognizance or on a conditional release. So there is no disadvantage to a defendant. In fact, I'll leave it.
Other questions? Representative Bryant.
The amendment, I think it's page 4, line 11, amends a 30-day period in which the court files a judgment for collection to 180 days.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could comment on the obviously it gives the insurer time to locate the defendant. I'm wondering why quite so long.
Well, that seems to be industry-wide, the what other states have provided for. It seems to be a reasonable period of time. The underlying concept here is that a defendant should not be rewarded for his failure to appear in a criminal case. And the most important thing here is that if there is a failure to appear, that the insurance company be given an opportunity to locate the defendant, and then through the assistance of local police or the state police, apprehend that defendant and bring him before the courts. There has to be some reasonable period of time, and 180 days is seemingly the industry standard, although that is certainly not cast in stone.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Van Baum, do you have a compelling question?
Oh, well, I don't know about that.
I just want to know what kind of premium you charge for this kind of service above the money that's obviously put up front.
Now, are you serious?
I was curious.
Premiums generally for bonds are 10%, and that is why the state of Oregon adopted 10% security release back in 1973. The industry standards are 10% goes to the insurance company. Of course, they have a tremendous amount to lose should the defendant fail to appear, and the risk they take is substantial. But the services they provide is also something that has never been picked up by any government agency since bonds were abolished in 1973, and the results are pretty self-explanatory, that defendants regularly thumb their nose at the criminal justice system by their failure to appear and are rewarded. The defendants who appear faithfully are the ones that suffer full measure of the law. The ones that fail to appear are rewarded because there is no one who tracks them down.
Representative Mannix. Or Minnis.
You know, this guy.
I have a question.
They've even separated them. That's what's so sad. I
swear.
I'm
just
kind
a
of legislatively dyslexic.
On page 2, line 19, there's a reference to ORS 135265, subs 3 and 4. And in looking at the statute, there is no sub 4. Is that a technical amendment that needs to be changed? Sub 2, sub 1, 2, and 3, but no sub 4.
Yes, thank you. And there is one other housekeeping change which I should call to your attention as well, and that is on page 4, line 4. The following words should be added by interlineation. After the word release, there should be a comma, and the following words, or corporate surety bond. That was also deleted, so thank you for that.
What line is it on?
Line.
What page, too, Mr. Horton?
Pardon me, it's on page 4.
Line
4.
Page 4, line 4. Anything further? I'm in a real peculiar position. I kind of like the bill.
Let me move it to full committee or what?
Well, just to. But I've had a strong suggestion from one of my judges, Judge Snoffer, who you may or may not, and who is a constituent. And
what is the judge's position on this?
I think he'd like to. You can imagine Judge Snoffer was the article author of the original, but he sent a strong suggestion. He'd like to comment on the bill. Now, unless you guys want to, I mean, I'm not going to, I kind of like the bill.
But what are you telling us? You want to move it, or are you waiting for Joe?
No, I'm
going
to overwhelm you, Mr. Chair. No, I.
You want to vote no, we can vote yes.
Is he going to speak against it?
That's what my impression is. And I don't know, Mr. Hatcrawford, do you communicate with
Mr. Chairman, in all honesty, we have not. We suspected someplace along the line that he might wish to comment on it. I guess I can only say to you that we, you know, that we're willing certainly to listen to his comments. I don't think any of us, between the proactive and the defense of this situation, are probably going to change our minds about it whatsoever. But that's you know, that's neither here nor there, I
well,
guess.
Let me discuss something. As long as if somebody skips bond and it's the bail bondsman has to use a police officer to arrest them, I assume I've read the bill right? I don't want to ever get back in the situation that used to be. That was not a good situation. I don't know how many of you ever had anything.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one of the things that we've tried to do in the bill, recognizing that was one of the early criticisms, is to make sure that the insurance division has all the authority they should possibly need to write rules and regulations for the protection of the public. What we really have discovered, and this isn't, there's no secret to this, if you talk to law enforcement, they will tell you that in their opinion, they could make the 10% law work as well as corporate surety bonds. Now, you also know what the other part of the... If we gave them enough money to where they could put the people out to be able to pursue. And that really is the crux of the question from the public policy point of view. And the other is, I think, again, the emphasis that the judge may very well not agree with me on, just from philosophy, but the fact of the matter is that undoubtedly a large number of people will be continued on the 10% rule. The 10% rule is here to stay in Oregon, it would appear, and we have no argument against that.
What's the committee's pleasure, Representative Mannix?
May I inquire whether District Attorney Dale Penn from Marion County is interested in testifying at all or commenting on this measure?
He's next up on another bill, but
we go to anybody.
Willing to hear from him. Mr. Penn, do you want to
you know what we're talking about?
The seat of your pants here?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mannix, I have talked to... we have seen this bill before, and last session it wasn't introduced, as I understand, and Mr. Horton presented it to our organization, and as an organization we endorsed it primarily because we felt that it gave another option available in some of the tough cases. And although we haven't taken an official position this time, I don't know of any opposition in the organization.
Stevie. Thank you.
If Stevie will say yes, it's gone.
Representative Calori.
I want to go back to a question that was asked earlier, just to make sure I understand. There was Representative Minnis asked about the additional time to locate and determine reason for failure to appear, and you said it was industry standard. Why, is that kind of separate from what we're doing here? But we are changing it, so I'm wondering, are we changing it because of some aspect of surety bonds? Are we changing it because it ought to be changed anyway, or what?
Well, under the present system, there is no reason to delay beyond 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
If a defendant has failed to appear after the passage of 30 days, there's no reason not to issue a warrant and to forfeit the security. Because there is no one under the present system that is out there looking for the defendant. And under a corporate surety system, there is. And so it's just to provide the opportunity. If the most important thing here is to get that defendant before the bar of justice, then a reasonable period of time should be allotted to the insurance company. I think that's the
one. Mr. Chair, is anybody else signed up on the bill?
No, that's why I'm... Mr. Remington, do you have a... comment on this either way?
Well, you do.
Yes, please.
I said this.
We're not bashful here asking for you come into the room, you know.
Stevie like Remington, American Civil Liberties Union. This one snuck up on me.
Oh.
I somehow missed the bill or missed getting it on my list. The ACLU will definitely oppose it. Bill Snaufer was, when he was Judge Snaufer. When he was lobbying, was our representative on that issue. I think also the public defender, Jim Hennings, will be interested in appearing because he was very vocal in his opposition, in support of Article 8 of the Criminal Code.
Representative Bount.
Could you articulate the reasons why you're in opposition?
Representative Bount. It was primarily because of enormous abuses, and what I'm not sure of, and the reason I didn't want to appear on this, is because there are changes in what existed before and what this happens, and I want one of our attorneys to analyze it before and speak knowledgeably.
The abuses...
Well,
I think you've got to understand some history here, and I'm not advocating the bill that much, but and I know about these abuses. In fact, I made a substantial fee off of bail bonds from one who was a little over-enthusiastic. I mean, I'm sure you know about that type of thing. They make great suits afterwards.
I remember that case, in fact.
Yeah, right. But that's what she's talking about, is the baggage. And I don't know, Representative Mannix?
We're not giving bail bondsmen any opportunity or a right under this
arrest
to law proposal.
That was my
to
point.
Arrest. And I'm wondering, in terms of the ACLU's position, this does not undo the opportunity for any citizen to post the 10% and recover it, which is different. I mean, this is an alternative that's being added on. Isn't that a different situation from what we had before?
Representative Max, yes, that is why I did not want to testify today until I have someone look at the differences in the system and come to a reasoned position.
This gives an additional option for an individual, innocent to proven guilty, to get out in the streets. Why would you oppose that? No, I don't understand that at all. I thought you'd be championing this thing.
Let me come to a rest.
Representative Courtney, we are opposed to opening the door to the abuses that existed under the old system, where they were pressured into getting their mother to sign.
That's cleaner language. That the use of the word primarily is also there because there are times when one can always argue about very fine points as to design, and this makes you look at the whole substance of the design or redesign. The Third Amendment, Amendment C for page 2, lines 39 through 40, was based on some recommendations we heard during testimony, and that was you don't get into intent at all if you're going to talk about possession of these things, and that's going to be a crime, then manufacturing these things without all the licensing exceptions and all of that is also a crime, period. We don't get into the intent argument at all.
Representative Mannix moves the amendments you just outlined in a document entitled Miranda. Starting on the left-hand corner, two House Judiciary Subcommittee and Crime and Corrections from Joel and the Committee Council, Ray, HB 2188, date 12489. The document containing amendments. Discussion of the amendments. Any objection to the amendments? So adopted, Representative Mannix?
I move the full bill to the full committee as amended.
Representative Bryan?
Mr. Chairman, one additional item we had that my notes indicate is the offense of manufacturing this device, if I recall, is a Class B misdemeanor. We had only a brief discussion to it at the end of the meeting that Section 5 on page 2, I think it was pointed out that the production and manufacture of this device was only a Class B misdemeanor, but the possession of it was being suggested as a Class C felony, and that we need to bring those in line, perhaps. Someone could sit there and produce these things and sell them or give them away, and it's a Class B misdemeanor.
It's be terribly hard to produce them without possessing them.
Well, as I understand, and I think Representative Baum looked it up that day, statute he found had this reference being a Class B misdemeanor.
Now, what to make it symmetrical, what would it be then?
Mm-hmm. Just the chair's point is that once you manufactured them, you possess them, so it would automatically be a Class C felony, but it would be good to eliminate the misdemeanor reference so that it's not confusing to anyone at some point.
Be an interesting defense. I didn't possess it, I just manufactured it.
You want to take this case?
What? We need the manufacturing
provision?
That's the argument, Paul, that if you ever possess it, you're manufacturing it in a way.
But you can possess it without having manufactured it.
But you can't do that. You can't.
But you cannot manufacture it without possessing it.
Mm-hmm. What if it's not completed?
How about,
it's not
Mr. Chair, how about a person who was no longer in possession of it, but was found to have, proven to have manufactured it?
Then you'd still be liable for having possessed it at the time of manufacturing. Well, she's pointed out that if it's in stages of development, then you might be, you caught him in the, or her, in the middle. Manufacturing might not apply.
Right.
It only occurred.
Apologize, Mr. Chair.
It's what your pleasure, Representative Bryan. Do you want to leave well enough alone, or do you
I'm
want
not, to... I'm not really... All I'm saying is that I wanted to make sure the committee... I mean, there seems to be a real disparity there between someone who is manufacturing these things. I wouldn't want them to be in a better position than someone who simply possesses them.
No. you're being coy here. Do you want to change the law or not?
If someone could suggest how to get that done, I would.
Make it into a C felon.
Yes. That would be my intent.
Now, Representative Baum, before I place the motion, where are you at?
It is inconsistent, and I know it's charged with a charge, and I'll be charging with the Class C if they're going to be caught manufacturing, but it does create kind of some confusion.
Why are they going over this? Mr. Hughes, are you uncomfortable, or are you here to comment on this? Or? Okay, I just want everybody to get their,
A little bomb shy.
Get a little bomb shy. I don't, he's got so many accounts, I never know. Representative Mannix.
I would suggest that we instruct council to propose a technical amendment to amend ORS. I don't have it in front of me.
48220.
Well, actually, it's a subsequent one that refers back to 220. It's about 260, I think.
489990 subparagraph 6.
489990 subparagraph 6.
To specifically amend then the reference in there to the crime to bring it in conformity with what we're doing today.
Okay. So that was, I think, the gist of your motion.
Yes.
Any objections to this?
I agree.
Any comments? Any objections to the amendment? Amendment's adopted. Then Brian?
Yes.
Move it to the floor.
Yes,
moves House Bill 2188 to the full committee. Do pass recommendation as amended. Further discussion. If
I would just like to point out just one point. Don't everybody flinch. Just wanted to point out.
Oh no.
I got it. Wanted to point out the potential impact on the Indigent Defense Fund.
Yes.
Where's over
there? Potential impact in Indigent Defense.
Make a standing comment on anything.
Yeah, I want a neon sign back there. Indigent Defense.
Kind of like Groucho Marx when you say the magic word, little bird comes down.
That's it. Just,
happy to do that for you.
So it gives you money, it takes it away from you. Okay. With that. Yeah. Representative Baum.
We have 1 minute to think about. I think we're going to have a problem with this statutory scheme if we don't think this through carefully.
Yeah, I think the reference is that other elements in that 480 chapter are talking mainly misdemeanors for a variety of things regarding explosives.
And violation of transfer regulations and transport. I mean, we're getting open up a little bit of a...
But our technical amendment was only in regard to destructive device as defined in our bill.
Yeah,
it doesn't have to do with all those other explosives.
Pyrotechnic devices are excluded.
Yeah, well, go on, roll.
Well, Representative Baum, I think that's one of the reasons why you'll work with learned counsel on this.
Okay, that's fine. We'll work it. Okay, that's fine.
Also, he will blow the horn at full committee if it's still a crisis situation, Representative.
No, I don't.
Well, if he does his work well, there will be nothing to blow on.
Moving on.
We have yet to get to the stage in the session where we're doing conceptual amendments yet. We've been known to do a few of those, right, Representative Courtney?
Mm-hmm. Yes, like the whole bill. This concept to do this, it went out the floor. We killed it, carried a few concepts out on the floor with no paper.
Yeah. Okay.
Think about that for a second. It's really tough to try that.
I think the U.S. Bob Packwood carried a whole tax code. There's no further discussion. The clerk will call the roll.
Representatives Bauman.
Aye.
Bryan.
Aye.
Calori.
Aye.
Courtney.
Yes.
Mannix.
Yes.
Miller.
Aye.
Baum.
Aye.
Mr. Chair.
Aye. Bill passes. Anything further for the good of the order?
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Bauman.
Does the representative from the Eastern Bloc pronounce his name Baum or Baum?
Eastern Bloc?
And if it is Representative Baum, I would suggest that the chair assign him this bill.
Representative?
That's too good of an opportunity for targeting on the floor with that kind of situation. But if we work out the appropriate technical amendments, I pay no problem with that.
You think your name isn't joining?
Uh-huh.
Pyrotechnical.
Oh, it's pressed.
Could you say?
Thank you very much. Nothing further. We'll call it a day.
Out there, I'm not a great bond.
Let's go.
And here it is. It's very bound because.